Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's Char Share It program. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. Later, you will have the opportunity to ask questions during the question-and-answer session. You may register to ask a question anytime by pressing star and one on your touch-tone phone, and you may withdraw yourself from the queue by pressing the pound key. Please note this call is being recorded. It's now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Shiraz Dubinsky. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Keith, and good evening to all of you. Welcome to our national webinar called New for You: Updates in Testing and Treatment Options for Hereditary Breast and Ovarian Cancer. My name is Shiraz Dubinsky, and I am the Director of Navigation and Support Services at Char Share It. Before we begin, we'd like to thank AstraZeneca for their very generous contribution to tonight's program and to the cooperative agreement DP14-1408 from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. We very much appreciate their support, particularly around these important topics that particularly are of concern to those in the Jewish community. For those of you who are not familiar with us, Char Share It is a national non-for-profit organization supporting young Jewish women and their families facing breast cancer. Our mission is to offer a community of support to women of all Jewish backgrounds diagnosed with breast cancer or at an increased genetic risk, and we are fostering culturally relevant, individualized connections with a network of peers, health professionals, and related resources. I do want to say that although our expertise is in Jewish women and young women, we offer support to anybody who reaches out to Char Share It, and we want to be there for all of you at any point in your journey and at any time. Certainly feel free to continue to be in touch with us even after this evening's program. In the general population, one in 345 individuals carry the BRCA gene mutation. Of those of Ashkenazi Jewish descent, meaning those who have ancestors from Eastern Europe, that number is 1 in 40. So this is certainly very much a concern to the Jewish community because those of Ashkenazi Jewish descent are 10 times more likely to carry the BRCA gene mutation. And what does that really mean? It means that those who are carriers of the BRCA gene mutation have as high as an 80% lifetime risk of being diagnosed with breast cancer and as high as a 40% lifetime risk of being diagnosed with ovarian cancer. So these are the kind of things that Sheila Solomon will be addressing in her presentation tonight. Before I introduce Sheila, I want to say that we're very excited to have Sheila on board. She's been with us for several months. So this is an opportunity to actually publicly introduce her to the Char Share It community. She will, in addition to tonight's presentation, Sheila consults with women and families and answers individual questions about family histories, the BRCA mutations, and personal risk of hereditary breast cancer and ovarian cancer. And she also contributes to the development and implementation of Char Share It's hereditary cancer resources and programs. The other thing that Sheila will be able to do, and I want to encourage all of you to take advantage of it, is she can facilitate family conference calls. And the value in that is that I'm sure many of you have families that live all across the country. And it's an opportunity for all of you to get on the phone at once and to have a conversation in real time without this one passing along information and maybe, a question wasn't asked. So I encourage you to take advantage of this resource and the ability to have these family conference calls. Sheila is also a customer service genetic counselor for GeneDx. So with that, I am actually going to hand the floor over to Sheila, and I'm very excited for her to address many questions that we have received, both pertaining to this particular webinar and also throughout the year. Sheila, go ahead.
Thank you so much, Shira, and thank you, everyone, for attending this evening. I'm looking forward to speaking with you and sharing some of the updates that we know now in hereditary breast cancer and ovarian cancer. And as Shira mentioned, I am consulting with Shar Sherrod and have had just such a pleasure speaking with so many of you and hearing about your stories and sharing your insights. And I look forward to hearing your questions and conversations this evening as well. So without further ado, let's get started. Next slide, please. So just a quick agenda for this evening's discussion. We've already had our welcome, and thank you very much for that. I wanted to review with you and update the newest, latest and greatest, if you will, in hereditary or inherited breast cancer and ovarian cancer, and really then bring everything back home to say, well, then what are my next steps? You know, what are the next steps for you and your families? What does this mean for me? What does this mean for my family? And where do we go from here? Next slide, please. So what is genetic about breast cancer? What is genetic about ovarian cancer? Well, to give you a very quick answer, everything is genetic about breast cancer and ovarian cancer. Cancer in general is caused by genetic changes, or what we call mutations, that occur inside the cells of our bodies that make those cells unruly and unable to control how they're growing properly in the body, and that can ultimately develop into a tumor. But not all cancer is hereditary, meaning that that genetic component is actually caused or inherited from parent to child. So taking things to a global view, cancer is a common disease. Unfortunately, there are very few people who haven't been touched by cancer in one way or another, meaning we know someone close with us, someone in our family, even ourselves. Cancer can even occur in family members, even when there is no inherited cause specifically. So we can oftentimes observe two sisters with cancer, two brothers with cancer, even though there may not be a hereditary cause. However, and where we're going to focus tonight is on those families where there is a hereditary pattern to cancer, okay? So we all have risk factors to develop cancer. Can you move to the next slide, please? Thank you. We all have risk factors to develop cancer. What I wanted to focus on tonight is the risk factors for the two common cancers that we're speaking of, which is breast and ovarian cancer. One of the greatest risk factors is aging. As we age, there is an increased risk to develop breast cancer. If there's a family history of breast cancer or potentially other cancers, there's also an increased risk to develop that cancer. If an individual has already had a cancer personally, there is an increased risk for her to develop a breast cancer, potentially. And there are also certain environmental and lifestyle exposure-based factors, such as beginning periods at young ages, having change of life or menopause at a later age in the later 50s, 60s, not having biological children or having them later in life, perhaps. The hormonal factors that can also increase a woman's risk to develop breast cancer are in play. There are also genetic risk factors, which we'll talk about in a moment. Next slide, please. In speaking to the general risk factors for ovarian cancer development, aging, family history, personal experience of cancer previously also fall in line with risk factors for this type of cancer, so very similar to the risk for breast cancer. Next slide, please. So then what is it about cancers that are different when they are sporadic, meaning they just happen by chance due to personal risk factors, environment, unknown risk factors, and then the hereditary type? So as I mentioned, all cancer is genetic, meaning it's caused by genes that are changed in our cells that increase that potential for cancer to develop, but not all cancer is hereditary, meaning it's inherited in families. So moving to the next slide, how much breast cancer and ovarian cancer is actually hereditary? When we take a look at all breast cancers diagnosed, only 5 to 10% of all breast cancers are actually caused by a hereditary cause. If you flip that number around, we're talking 90 to 95% of cancers might be of breast cancers might be caused by other factors. So just right off the bat, it's a small portion of cancer that actually is hereditary. On the other hand, ovarian cancers are a relatively rare cancer overall in the general population. So a quarter of ovarian cancers may be hereditary, in fact. So what does this mean for me? This is bringing it back to the audience here who's joining us this evening to say, what does this mean for me? Well, if you've had a personal or family history of one of these cancers, it may be worthwhile learning more because it could, in fact, be a hereditary cause. It may be a chance that you fit into that 5 to 10% or 25% of the population. So let's learn more about genetics in our genes before we get into these updates. Next slide, please. Thank you. So our genes are like books. You think about a book sitting in a library on a shelf. That particular book has a particular job to do.
Sheila, we're not able to hear you. Okay.
Sheila, looks like Sheila's line has dropped. We'll need her to dial back in.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Keith. So just like a good book, we're in suspense right now to see what happens next. So please hang in with us while Sheila gets back on the line, and she will pick it up from there. So thank you for your patience.
Hello, I'm back. I do apologize.
Great. Welcome back.
Thank you very much. Apologies for the technical difficulties. All right, where were we? So we were speaking about our genes. What are our genes? Our genes are the instructions for our bodies, tell us how to grow, how to look, how our bodies function. And so in thinking about our genes, similar to being like books, a book is almost like an instruction manual, if you will, just like a gene is the instruction code for our body. If you think about books, books are made of letters and words and so forth. In our English alphabet, we've got our 26 letters that we string together to make words and sentences and books. The genetic alphabet is made of 4 letters, and those letters are strung together in chemical version, if you will, inside the cells of our body, and those particular letters are the DNA. Those are the genetic code that make up our genes. Now, our genes, just like a book, must be spelled properly in the correct spelling order, so that the body can understand what that particular gene's instruction is to do. If there's missing letters or extra letters in that gene book or missing pages or chapters, if you will, then that gene book doesn't make sense to the body and the body can't do its job properly to keep us healthy. So the same thing happens in books. Just like if you were reading a book and there were missing pages, it wouldn't make sense and you'd put that book back up on the shelf and not use it properly. So if that was important book for your job or to do whatever it was that you were reading about, then you're going to be lacking information and can't do your job properly. Next slide, please. In thinking about the way that this affects Ashkenazi Jewish community, this is actually a diagram of the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes. So imagine these gray bars as a book, and each one of these lines represents a different chapter in the book. And there happen to be 3 different spots noted here by the orange arrows that are the common mutations or areas in the book where there are spelling mistakes, these mutations, in the Ashkenazi Jewish community. There happen to be 2 different spelling mistakes that are common in BRCA1 and 1 common mutation or spelling mistake in BRCA2. So as a review of the previous slides, given that the genes are like books, we want to see whether or not these particular changes are found at those sites in the gene. Individuals of Ashkenazi Jewish ancestry have a 1 in 40 chance of having one of these spelling mistakes at one of these 3 spots in the gene. And this is specific to our ancestry. This is what we call a founder mutation. Next slide, please. So what is a founder mutation? A founder mutation is a little complex and requires us to take a step back in time, if you will. So let's imagine on the left-hand side of the slide here, you see these three photographs or these three pictures. And in many, many generations ago in Eastern Europe, let's imagine a shtetl where many families lived, where children played. And in that particular town, there may have been a handful of families who had a BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutation. And as we know, the Jewish families like for their children to marry Jewish family into other Jewish families. And then over time, the prevalence of the particular mutation may have increased because the genes were staying within the community. Now, as we also know, many Jews immigrated to other parts of the world, including the United States. So on the right-hand side of the slide, imagine that those two people noted with the blue arrows left Europe, fled Europe, and happened to also carry a BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutation. Okay, next slide. They arrived in the United States, they set up their lives and established their families in a new, smaller Jewish community where the prevalence of that mutation was now greater, right? Because now those two people are setting up shop in New York or Philadelphia or wherever they might have been in the world. And over time, as many of us know, again, firsthand perhaps, the Jewish children grew to adulthood, went on to marry other Jewish people. Thus, the genes stay within the community. And if that person carried a BRCA mutation over time and many generations later, the prevalence of that mutation grew too. So once again, 1 in 40 Ashkenazi Jews carries one of these two mutations. Okay. So for those individuals, Jewish or non-Jewish, who carry a BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutation, there are increased risks for cancer. Let's talk about that. Next slide. Thank you. In thinking about the risks for BRCA1 and BRCA2 mutation carriers, the cancer risks, as Shira was mentioning, are quite staggering. They're much higher than the general population risks. For BRCA1 mutation carriers, the risk for breast cancer is upwards of 85%, similar to BRCA2 mutation carriers. The ovarian cancer risk for BRCA1 mutation carriers is somewhat increased compared to BRCA2 mutation carriers. BRCA1 mutation carriers have up to a 54% chance to develop ovarian cancer, and as it's a bit higher than the BRCA2 population. We also know that there are other cancers included in this spectrum, so that prostate cancer in men, pancreatic cancer, male breast cancer, and in some families we've observed gastric cancer and melanomas as well. And this is an important fact to think about. I mentioned prostate cancer and male breast cancer. Next slide, please. So thinking about the men, this is something that might be a misconception in the population in some cases, that it's an important point to recognize that men are at increased risk for cancer if they carry these gene mutations, which also tells us that they can clearly inherit and pass on these gene mutations. So it's very important, just as important to know your mother's side of the family history as well as your father's side of the family. So I know that breast cancer tends to be a female disease. Obviously, ovarian cancer is a female disease. However, the risk to develop that disease has equal likelihood to be passed from the father's side of the family or the mother's side of the family. So when you think about the holidays coming up and Thanksgiving and so forth and gatherings, it's important to discuss your father's family in addition to your mother's family's health history. Okay. We see here with male breast cancer, BRCA1 and BRCA2 mutation carriers have an increased likelihood to develop a male breast cancer. So this is important for the men listening or for the women who have loved ones who are male in the audience here tonight. All right, next slide, please. So now that we have the primer about hereditary cancers, about hereditary breast cancer, let's talk about the updates. Where are we now? What is really interesting, and this is a mini agenda, if you will, what I'd like to talk about are about five different points tonight. The first is the fact that BRCA1 and BRCA2, while I've reviewed those here tonight, they are no longer the only players in the inherited cancer genetics game, if you will. The idea of inherited cancer panel testing is here to stay, and I'll introduce what that means in just a moment. I also wanted to discuss the idea of lifestyle changes, as this has been something that has been brought to the media and to some of the scientific audiences. population screening for genetic testing, a brief update in treatments related to genetics, and then the concept of online research databases and research studies. Okay. Next slide, please. So as I mentioned, it's more than just BRCA1 and BRCA2 anymore. This particular table represents a handful of relatively newer genes, not necessarily all new genes, but newer genes in the game of panel testing. These are a set of genes here in the left-hand column that are listed below the word gene. And each of them is denoted with a different letter symbol, as you see. On the right-hand side of the table, it represents the cancers that are associated with gene mutations in that gene. So if you're looking at these rows and you see breast cancer and pancreatic cancer and colon cancer, if you think to your family history, wow, that sure sounds like my family, it may be one of these kinds of genes here that's associated with the family history and something to evaluate. How would we go ahead and evaluate these genes? Next slide, please. So what we can talk about now is how these tests are performed. Inherited cancer panel testing for multiple genes is available now, more available now than ever. Many different laboratories around the country offer what's called next-generation sequencing, which is a new technology that allows the laboratory to analyze many genes at the very same time. In years past, technology only allowed one or two genes to be tested individually, and it was more of a cherry-picking to say which genes should we test for, where should we go based on the family history. Now, because the technology has advanced and the price of testing has been reduced significantly, meaning that the cost of testing is a fraction of what it had been years ago, this next generation sequencing looking at panels of multiple genes is able to provide more information than a single test ever could. It's very important to discuss these options with a certified genetic counselor or with your genetics healthcare provider before ordering this kind of testing. Genetic testing is a very sensitive topic, and it's very important to be informed before having your test ordered and performed. Next slide, please. So the next set of slides that I'd like to share with you are referencing some very new data that has come out in the past couple of months. These are publications that have been presented at our most recent genetics conferences this past fall. This is a study here by Rinsky et al., who studied over 3,500 patients who reported having Ashkenazi Jewish heritage and underwent this inherited cancer panel testing. So if you think again, this is a series of many, many genes being evaluated beyond just BRCA1 and 2. What they identified is that patients who were tested, 20% of those individuals had BRCA1 and BRCA2 mutations, which were not one of those three Jewish founder mutations. Further, they found approximately 17% of those patients who were Jewish had a CHEK2 mutation, which is another newer gene that has been identified in hereditary breast cancer. And further, 12% approximately carried ATM mutations. There were many other genes also that had been detected with mutations. So what does this mean for me? How does this study impact me as a Jewish person? Well, what this study tells us is that there are more players in the inherited cancer world than just the three founder mutations that I showed you earlier with those orange arrows, those three founder mutations in BRCA1 and BRCA2. So if you had previous negative mutation testing years ago for BRCA1 and 2, it might be worth discussing the option of panel testing with your healthcare provider now. Next slide, please. So CHEK2 is another more popular gene as it's coming out in the Jewish community and in the general population as well. We've received many calls here at Shar Sheret regarding cancer risks in CHEK2 and what does it mean to have a CHEK2 mutation, because we do observe individuals of Eastern European heritage and Jewish heritage with CHEK2 mutations. So recently, Liedem et al. Studied the family histories of cancer in over 500 different people with CHEK2 mutations. What they were looking at is a founder mutation that is common in Eastern European individuals, specifically Jewish individuals as well, and look to see if the cancer risks or the family histories of cancer were different between the type of mutation in CHEK2. And what they found was the cancer risks, which are about twofold risk for breast cancer, were not different between whether a person had a founder mutation in CHEK2 or a non-founder mutation, meaning any other spot in the gene. Remember, we talked about genes being like books. So it's quite possible that person A may have the founder mutation in the gene, which is in a particular spot, but that maybe someone else has a different spot in the gene book that is abnormal or has the mutation. Okay. So this is a gene, CHEK2 is a gene that can increase the risk for breast cancer, endometrial cancer, and other cancers as well, and is an up-and-comer in terms of conversations about cancer risk. Next slide, please. Thank you. Something else to discuss is the idea of young women with breast cancer, which is also always a conversation that we're having here at Shar Sharit. It's how to address our young women with breast cancer and their concerns over genetics and many other factors in their lives. Angelina et al. Studied over nearly 850 young women with breast cancer who had been diagnosed at age 45 or younger. And all of these women underwent inherited cancer panel testing. And about 10%, 1 in 10, were found to have a BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutation, which is certainly in line with having an early age diagnosis of breast cancer. But what was most interesting is that almost two-thirds of the mutations that were identified were actually not in BRCA1 or BRCA2. And in fact, half of the mutations detected were in newer described genes. So again, when I talked about the panel testing being able to simultaneously evaluate genes, many, many genes, this study was able to say, look, we found surprising finds with panel testing. And what it's essentially meaning for me, what does this mean for me? Well, it means having the conversation with your healthcare providers, if previous genetic testing has been done and is negative, to consider the options of panel testing because BRCA 1 and 2 may not be the only cause to the cancer in a family. Next slide, please. Okay, lifestyle modifications. So this is also something that has been discussed most recently. This is the idea of breast self-awareness. So I'm actually pulling this a bit away from genetics at this point, but this is a really important piece of information to share with your loved ones and to be aware of for yourself. The first idea is be aware it's not just performing a self-breast examination monthly. It is being aware of what the normal breast feels like, what it looks like. When do you notice that it changes throughout the monthly cycle? Being aware of your personal and family history risk factors, and of course, undergoing mammograms. Now, regarding mammograms, the American Cancer Society recently published some updates in terms of screening guidelines recommending that women of average risk for breast cancer begin their mammograms and their annual screening at the age of 45, no longer 40, and screen every 2 years from the age of 55. They also suggested that women who have a family history of breast cancer or those who carry a BRCA mutation may need to begin screening between the ages of 40 and 44 and more frequently in the 50s. For most of the women in our Shar Sharit community, including you here tonight on the call, Jewish women of Ashkenazi Jewish descent, we generally do not fall into these guidelines because of the ethnic background in terms of the increased risk for a potential genetic mutation. So it's very important to speak with your healthcare provider regarding your risk and whether you fall into that average risk or if you fall into an increased risk. And that can help determine the appropriate screening management guidelines for you. Next slide, please. Thanks. Another controversial and discussion point that has been brought to the public media and to the press recently is the concept of population screening for BRCA1 and BRCA2 mutations. There was a recent study published, if you look to the left of the slide here, looking at population-based screening considerations for breast and ovarian cancer due to BRCA1 and BRCA2. And this was a study performed with a number, it's an international collaboration, in fact, that considered the possibility of actually performing population-based screening in the Jewish community. Further, there was a recent New York Times op-ed piece that was also published that had brought quite a bit of discussion to the Shar Sharit community in regard to population screening and is this the right thing for me? Is this the right thing for all Jewish women? The most important take-home point from these recent discussions and from these posts is to speak with your family, speak with your healthcare provider and or a genetic counselor to learn more about your specific risk. Okay, because everyone has a specific risk based on family and personal risk factors that we talked about tonight, and not all of those risk factors are family history based or genetic based. Some very well may be environmentally based, some may be hormonally based, and so the risks are really personalized, and we recommend that you speak with your healthcare providers to better understand and pinpoint your risk and make good decisions from there. Next slide. Thank you. So I wanted to touch briefly on treatment updates because that was also part of the discussion tonight about what are the new latest and greatest discussions in treatment of breast or ovarian cancer. And as we discussed tonight, cancer is caused by genetic mutations, and sometimes those mutations can be inherited. So we know that ovarian cancer tumors that have been caused by a mutation in BRCA1 or BRCA2 or another gene called PALB2, if you're familiar with that particular gene, those particular tumors may be sensitive to a new type of chemotherapy called a PARP2 inhibitor. And this is an excellent example of how far we have come with genetic testing and how genetic testing results can help personalize medical care and treatment for women with ovarian cancer. So this allows us to better understand the causes of cancer and to target those tumors for a better response and hopefully for a prolonged survival. Next slide, please. Okay, so what's next? Well, we ask for you to stay in touch. This is a very young science, the science of genetics. We are learning more and more every day. Just in the past few weeks, as you see here, all of the data that I'm sharing with you has actually just been published in the past couple of weeks and months. This is all new from the second half of 2015, for that matter. So please do stay in touch because genetics is always being updated. And with that, I wanted to comment on the fact that there is a lot of important research for genetics that's out there. So share your results with your providers. Share your results with public databases. There's accessible databases and resources for women and men who have had genetic testing and have these variants or mutations that they're looking into more thoroughly. So the more we can share, the more we can learn. If you're interested in learning more, particularly for your own benefit or for that of your family, feel free to find a local genetic counselor by going to the website of the National Society of Genetic Counselors, www.nsgc.org. And there's a very quick link. It's very simple to find. And it says, find a genetic counselor near you, and you type in your zip code, and it will locate someone who's very close to you, and you can meet with them for a personalized discussion. We also would welcome you to stay in touch with Shar Sharit. Shar Sharit has counselors and information that is beyond your wildest imagination in terms of medical to emotional, psychosocial, supportive, in every way possible. So we are here as a resource for you all the time. With that, I would like to turn things back to Shira, and we will certainly take questions towards the end, but I do appreciate your time tonight and hope this has been a helpful, informative session.
Sheila, it has in fact been very informative, and I was thinking as you were speaking really how far we have come even since the last time we have done a teleconference on genetics, and it's very exciting to think about where we're going and where we will be over the next 2, 5, 10 years. So thank you for that. I do know that there was some technical issues with for some of you in terms of the audio and the slides. So I want to assure you that the audio, the slides, and the transcripts will be available on our website so that you can get it then. Next we have Lara, who is a Sharsheret link, a peer supporter, and she will share her personal story about her genetic history and experience with genetic testing. So Lara, the floor is yours.
All right, good evening, everybody. So as Shira said, my name is Lara, and I kind of have a different story than a lot of people, but ended up in the same place that a lot of people probably are. So basically, I'm interested in genealogy, and a couple years ago, I decided to take a test called 23andMe, which at the time would look at people's genetics and try to match people in terms of cousins. And so I took it to find cousins. At the time, it also tested for those three founder mutations. And to my extreme surprise, I was told I was positive for a BRCA2 mutation. It came as a complete shock. And obviously, I didn't have genetic counseling. I called my doctor, and luckily, she sent me to a genetic counselor who did a couple good things. She retested me. She also told me about Sharsheret, which is how I got to Sharsheret initially. Unfortunately, the retest in the official lab came back that I was still positive for a mutation. So I was sent for some initial screening and sent for my first ever mammogram because I was too young to have one before, and it was fine. But then because of the BRCA mutation, I was also sent for a breast MRI, which was not as clear. So I had a biopsy, and I was actually diagnosed with breast cancer, which would not have been caught had I not known I was BRCA positive, because it was the last thing on my mind. So it was early enough that it didn't require chemo. I did have some surgeries, and I had to talk, like I think Shira or Sheila mentioned earlier on, about talking to family members. I had to tell my family members that this was in the family, so I talked to a lot of them. Some tested positive, some tested negative, and some haven't tested, but they all are aware that it is something possible, that it's something in the family and something to be aware of. While it was very good that I did find out kind of by mistake, it was kind of difficult at the beginning, because it was taken as a complete surprise. When I first found out that I was positive, I didn't understand what it meant. So talking to a genetic counselor beforehand would have been wonderful. The fact that I had it afterwards did help me understand the ramifications and kind of the steps ahead that I needed to take. So that was actually really, really quick. I didn't expect to finish so quickly, but that's kind of my story. And I think it shows how important it is to know, to at least think about knowing if you are BRCA positive or not, or have one of the other mutations, just because it allowed me to be more proactive and find this cancer early.
Lara, thank you so much. And I think you're right. I think having the opportunity even to speak with a genetic counselor to decide whether or not genetic counseling is something that would be beneficial to you and family members is important. And I think the big takeaway message is that being able to speak with a genetic counselor, perhaps through testing, can be very empowering for many women and family members. So thank you very much for highlighting that. We are now going to have a question and answer session. And to ask a question, please dial *1, your questions will be addressed in the order that they are received. We're going to ask that you, when you do ask a question, to keep them somewhat broad in nature so that everybody on this evening's call can benefit from the conversation. So we've already had several questions come in. So Sheila, I'm going to throw the first one out to you. Is it possible to have a BRCA mutation and also have another gene mutation?
Good question, Shra. Yes, it is possible to have more than one gene mutation. As you know, we inherit half of our genes from our mother and half of our genes from our father. So it's possible that there may be one genetic syndrome or hereditary predisposition running on one side of the family and another on the opposite side of the family. So if you do have a family history of cancer on both sides of your family, it's important to have that evaluated by a genetic counselor.
Okay, great. Well, I guess on the heels of that, Sheila, somebody asked us, what should she do if she does not have her family history or does not know her family history?
Well, that's a tricky question because it is possible that there are a number of people who do not know their family's medical health history, and it really comes down to your comfort level of where you feel you fit on that risk scale in terms of screening, and are you comfortable with the current screening that you're getting with your doctors. If you are interested in more information to pinpoint what that risk might be, it might be worth a conversation with a genetic counselor and going through the risks and benefits of having genetic testing without knowing one's family history. Not to get off topic outside of the clinical or medical angle, but from an insurance perspective, insurance companies oftentimes require some medical necessity, some indication or reason to have this genetic testing. And usually that's based on a family or personal history of cancer. So not knowing your family history is sometimes a challenge to have a genetic test paid for by the insurance carrier if there's not an indication.
So we have actually received several questions about that in terms of the insurance company. So, one person said, do the insurance companies cover genetic counseling if you are BRCA positive?
The genetic testing or the genetic counseling piece?
Well, I guess they already know that they're already positive. So, I guess some people may do, some of these tests that before ever having had counseling. Maybe through their doctors. So if they did find out that they are positive, can they now go back to a genetic counselor, and have the insurance company cover that?
Mm-hmm. Right. Very good question. So certainly, and the genetic counseling meeting is really just like a doctor's office visit. In some cases, genetic counselors are not charging for the actual appointment. Other times they do charge. So it really depends on who you're going to see. But yes, insurance companies almost always will pay for the the genetic counseling, and also nowadays the genetic testing if there is that medical necessity piece. I'd really encourage you to speak with your insurance carriers and your family doctors to find out what your coverage might be.
Okay, we happen to be getting a lot of questions actually about insurance. So another question related is, does insurance or Medicare also pay for the panel testing?
Yes, good question. So yes, insurance carriers are starting to pay for the panel testing as they're realizing that it probably will be more helpful for them to know this information up front when a person is healthy and has not had cancer. Even if they have had cancer, it can be helpful information. So yes, Medicare does have criteria for genetic testing, and it can be coordinated and covered under certain, as long as the patient meets the criteria.
Mm-hmm. Okay, also related, we have received several questions actually about discrimination in terms of going for genetic testing. So I'm wondering if you can just briefly talk about the GINA Act, and then I'll ask a part two after that, but go ahead.
Sure, no problem. So that is a real concern for the community. However, we know that there have been very few to no cases brought to the courts regarding genetic discrimination. So as Sheraw was mentioning, GINA, G-I-N-A, is the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, which was signed by President Bush. This is an act that prohibits group health insurance plans from discriminating their constituents over their genetic test results. Even if a genetic test was paid for by the health insurance company, the insurance carrier would not be able to access that result or make decisions about someone's plan based on the genetic testing results. Now, there are some loopholes to this, and that is the fact that individual health insurance plans, like those personalized or independent plans, are not covered. as well as disability and life insurance are not covered under GINA. That being said, I wanted to reiterate that there have been few to no discriminatory cases brought to the courts based on genetic information and discrimination. I think this has been historically a concern in the community, but one that has really not been brought to fruition in real life in terms of action. If you think about the risks and benefits with the insurance carrier's perspective, you know, the insurance companies are playing the risk game all the time. They're thinking you're going to, they're playing that game. And so in thinking about paying for a test that costs $1,000 and if it's positive, then they know that they have probably saved themselves hundreds of thousands of dollars in treatment costs potentially for detecting a cancer, as in Lara's case, right? If she had not known that she was BRCA2 positive, she may not have had an early screening test to detect this cancer at an early curable stage. And then it may have cost many, many, many thousands of dollars in treatment for her, or worse, you know, treatment side effects and so forth over many, many years of follow-up. So this is where the genetic testing can be actually beneficial for the insurance carrier to know.
Okay, and so part two to that question, it talks actually about life insurance and long-term care. So can a, if somebody is testing BRCA positive, will that affect life insurance or long-term care insurance?
That's a really good question, and it's hard to say. It might be, but it really is a hard question to answer. It would be based on that plan, and I would suggest that you really do speak with your insurance agent to go through the ins and outs. Every insurance policy should have some specifics in regard to that. Some young families determine that they would like to get their life insurance squared away prior to undergoing genetic testing. That way they can answer all of the questions honestly to know that they have not been tested prior to securing that policy. But, you know, these are all really personal decisions, and I would suggest that you speak with your insurance agent or close friends to address those issues.
Okay. I now have three questions sitting in front of me, actually about the next generation. So one question is, if a woman does carry the BRCA mutation, what age should their daughter be tested or screened? What's the recommended age?
Right. So for women who have BRCA1 or 2 mutation, the age of for the next generation or for the younger women to or men even to consider testing would be age 18 when they are consenting adults. Now, these genes that I've spoken about tonight are not pediatric cancer genes. These don't affect children's development in terms of cancer risks. This is not even something that teenagers would develop cancers. We're talking adult onset conditions. Thus, we prefer from the genetic community, if you will, that at age 18 or older, when that individual is of adult and consenting age, they can make that choice for themselves as to whether they would like to know the testing or not, have the testing or not. Now, an 18-year-old may not want to know that information right then at that time in his or her life, and that's okay. Screening for breast and ovarian cancer would begin in the 20s if that person was positive or if that person decided they did not want the testing. Okay, because we wouldn't know if they're positive or negative if they weren't tested. So screening would begin in the 20s, but the genetic testing could begin as young as age 18.
Okay, and I guess if somebody is testing negative, but there is a family history, should they be getting tested? And I guess should it be the panel at that point?
Great question. So there are a number of folks who are going to panel testing following negative BRCA1 and 2 testing. It really comes down to the strength of your family history in terms of how many relatives in your family have had cancer and what types of cancer, and how old they were when they were diagnosed. So I would suggest revisiting your genetic counselor who ordered your BRCA1 or BRCA2 genetic testing and say, hey, I learned about this new panel testing that's out there now. And we're talking, this is only about 2 years old, 3 years old now, and ask them to say, is this something that would be worth looking into? Because it very well might be based on some of these studies that have come out this fall. It's not just BRCA1 and 2 anymore.
Right, and I guess that that would also apply to the woman herself, that if she tested BRCA negative, that's very possible that in doing the panel, it turns out that she is check 2 positive.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
That's exactly right.
So sticking with the theme of the next generation, we did get a question about how do you keep from passing the gene on to the next generation? So maybe if you can just briefly talk about, you know, maybe the IVF and anything else that would relate to that.
Sure, my pleasure. And this is a really interesting and I'd say controversial conversation to have. When we pass on our genes, we don't get to choose which genes get passed to our children naturally, right, if we're going the biological natural route. And we pass on a lot of wonderful traits to our children, as well as a number of them that we just don't have the choice whether or not to pass along. So there's a 50-50 chance, 1 out of 2, likelihood that a person who has a BRCA mutation or any of these gene mutations we're speaking of tonight to pass that gene mutation on to their children, each of their children, regardless of the gender of the child, regardless of the gender of the parent. What Shira is mentioning regarding IVF, which is in vitro fertilization, is that there's actually a new technique that is called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. Pre-implantation genetic diagnosis is also known as PGD. And it is a very highly specialized technique that is used with IVF testing or IVF treatment, whereby the sperm and egg the sperm fertilizes the egg in a petri dish, and then within the laboratory, and then the pre-implantation genetic diagnosis testing will test the fertilized egg for the mutation that is in that one of the parents, and the physicians will only implant the fertilized eggs which do not carry the mutation in the family into the mother. Now, this is a very controversial conversation, as I mentioned. It is a very expensive test that is and procedure, which I'm fairly certain is not covered by insurance, but it is available. It is something that can prevent this gene mutation from being passed to the next generation.
Thank you. We've received a couple of questions that I think may be more medical in nature. One having to do with the when to begin with the PARP inhibitor. And I guess I would encourage all of you who asked maybe more medical questions to really bring those up with your treatment team. Lara, we actually got a question for you that talks about they want to maybe know a little bit more information about how you decided to communicate the results to family members and how you went about doing that and basically how did that go?
Yeah, so that was probably one of the hardest parts of all this. So first I talked to my parents and my siblings. So my parents tested first, so we would know which side of the family it was coming from. And once those results came back, I sent a long email followed up by some phone calls to some cousins and just explaining basically the whole story that I said and how I, you know, if they wanted to get tested, I gave them the name of my genetic counselor and asked them to come to me with any questions, and I got a lot of questions, but most of them actually did get tested.
Okay, that's great, and I think that also highlights the service that Shar Sherrod offers in terms of being able to have everybody on a call at one time. So I like, Lara, that you provided people with a genetic, the name of a genetic counselor, but that's certainly something that we can do here at Shar Sherrod with Sheila to get all the family members on at one time. So thank you. Somebody asked, Sheila, if there is a family of breast cancer, are there any proactive treatments? I don't know if that's too medical or if you can just briefly address that.
certainly. So a family history of breast cancer, as we mentioned in the beginning of the talk tonight of the webinar, is a risk factor for developing breast cancer. So we know that right off the bat, whether or not anyone in the family has had genetic testing. So knowing if you have a family history of breast cancer can offer increased screening, an increased breast cancer screening program, which might include additional types of screening besides mammograms. So in addition to mammograms, depending on the strength of the family history and how many women and who has had breast cancer at what ages, a woman might actually be eligible to have what's called a breast MRI in addition to the mammogram. Now, while breast screening is not the same thing as prevention, and I know the caller's question was regarding prevention, we know that breast MRIs are highly sensitive and work very well in conjunction with mammograms in detecting early, early stage breast cancers. From the preventative standpoint, there are, there is some chemopreventive medications that can be taken to prevent breast cancer, but again, that's in a specific population of patients. I'm going to tell you something that I'm sure every physician and healthcare provider has always told you is everything in moderation in terms of diet and your health and exercise and alcohol intake and all of these things that are lifestyle exposures that we all are to take, to be aware of. But, this, I think you're probably catching my drift that there's really no easy answer for the preventative. It's really being aware and taking steps for screening early and often. And I think Lara is a success story of that.
And when you talk about screening, is there anything else in addition to mammograms and MRIs, particularly if somebody is BRCA positive?
Outside of breast screening, are you specific? So you're asking about other types of cancer screening?
Yeah.
So there certainly would be in the setting of a BRCA mutation in terms of ovarian cancer screening or consideration for prevention, removal of organs prior to developing cancer. So that means like preventative mastectomies, preventative oophorectomy, which is removal of the ovaries. These are very personal decisions, and while they are the greatest risk reduction services, they also come with risks. And so it's a conversation that's worth having with your providers, because these are very personal, and while they are medically invasive, they also can be invasive to you in terms of your appearance and your relationships and so forth. So these are not issues taken lightly. And so once again, Charshara can be there for you to answer those questions and to work through some of those issues. We're happy to help.
That's great. We also got something about is bladder cancer and other cancers an indicator for needing genetic testing? And I think you addressed that by saying that, probably the best bet on that is to make an appointment with a genetic counselor or to speak with you. Would you agree with that?
I would. For the most part, bladder cancer is not one of the common hereditary cancers. But there can be some rare types of bladder cancer that may be hereditary. So if you're at all concerned, a conversation with a genetic counselor is not a bad thing. It's just a conversation. It's just a meeting. Meeting with a genetic counselor does not mean you have to have testing.
Right.
The role of the genetic counselor is not to pressure anyone into such a decision.
Right. I want to emphasize that anybody calling into Charshara, we don't have an agenda for testing, but we certainly encourage people to have conversations with a genetic counselor to see whether or not you would benefit from testing. This is sort of an interesting question, Sheila. Do you foresee a time where panel testing may be part of the genetic testing when couples get married?
That is interesting. If I'm standing on my soapbox here, this is my own personal opinion, but I think this still comes down to the level of comfort and information that person is interested in learning. There are so many different levels of panel testing right now, ranging from 2 to 3 genes all the way up through many, many 30, 40, 50 different genes. So depending on what that couple might be interested in, sure, it may be something, but again, it's very, very personal and again, would have to be consented by both parties in understanding what the risks and benefits are and the limitations. We're working with a relatively young science here. So there may be changes very much so over the many years ahead.
Yeah, it looks like that. I want to encourage people to send questions or give us a call so that we can continue this conversation. And you can certainly call us to speak individually and have a one-on-one conversation with Sheila. You will be receiving an evaluation in your email. Please complete the online evaluation because your feedback is very important to us. And everything that we do is driven from your feedback and to really identify the issues and concerns that are important to all of you, and we want to make sure that we continue to address that. As I mentioned earlier, the transcript and audio will be available. So you can go to www.sharsherit.org/resources and transcripts. We'd like to again thank AstraZeneca for making this evening's program possible and for always supporting Sharsherit's programs. And we ask you to also stay connected with us and to continue this discussion or any other conversations that you would want to have with us. We also want to thank the Cooperative Agreement DP14/1408 from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. As we head into Thanksgiving, there is an American idiom called talk turkey. So on this American holiday of Thanksgiving, we encourage you to serve up a great conversation that sheds light on your family history. Since 2004, Thanksgiving has been declared Family Health History Day by the Surgeon General. This national public campaign encourages all American families to learn more about their family health health history. So we encourage all the families of Sharsher and all of you on tonight's call to collect and share information about your family health history with one another, because on a day that focuses on gratitude, we can be thankful that we live in a time where preventative health care is integrated into standard health practices. So, as you head into Thanksgiving next week, the next time you ask Grandma to pass the turkey, also have her include a healthy side dish of family history. So stay connected to us. You can give us a call. You can contact us on info@sharsherit.org. Visit us on our webpage. And you can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. So thank you very much for participating. And we look forward to staying in touch. Thank you again to Sheila and Lara for really such an important conversation tonight. Good night, everybody.